This is a podcast from Consilio. We bring people together to create better places.
Hello and welcome to Better Places, the podcast from Consilio where we talk about business, politics, planning and development. This week we are joined by Councillor Omid Miri, Chair of the Planning and Development Control Committee at Hammersmith and Fulham, to discuss all things planning and development in the borough and his campaign for the London Assembly.
Hello and welcome to Better Places podcast with myself, Sadu Dwyer.
Myself, Oscar Harmon.
And joined by a very special guest, the Chair of the Planning Committee in the London Borough of Hammersmith and Fulham, Councillor Omid Miri.
Hello, thank you very much for having me. I'm a very big fan, so honoured to be on the podcast. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and it's great to have you here on the show. So we're going to ask Omid a few questions around delivering new homes in the borough, his run for the London Assembly as a candidate on the list, and various other kind of contemporary topics around delivering new homes and planning regeneration in London. So, Oscar, to kick off?
Yeah, so starting with the first of them. So we've got, as you say, kind of three layers to this, really. One is the councillor layer, one is the chair of the planning committee layer, and then, of course, the slightly more regional role around the London Assembly. So you were first elected in May 2022. I think you mentioned that you've been immersed in Hammersmith and Fulham Labour Party for longer than that. But how have you found the first 18 months or so in your role as a councillor?
Well, it's definitely been a learning curve, and I was quite thrown in the deep end because as soon as I became a councillor, I became chair of the planning committee, having had no experience, obviously, being a councillor, but also no real experience with planning issues, not really understanding what the planning system was, how it all worked. So very, very much a learning curve. But it's forced me to learn a lot very quickly about planning.
And have you, obviously, you mentioned the chair of the planning committee role, but of course, as a newly elected councillor, you'll, of course, spent a lot of time in Fulham Reach in your ward. How have you found your role as a ward councillor, engaging with residents and different groups on that basis?
Yeah, it's been very interesting because Fulham Reach, maybe perhaps a microcosm of London, it's one third people privately renting, one third homeowners, and one third people in social housing. So you get the different sort of residence groups that are coming from a different perspective. Fulham Reach, obviously, there's been so much development there over the past sort of 5 to 10 years. I wasn't there when the development was approved or when it was really being built. But there is a lot going on, so you do get the different sort of perspectives. Some residents who live closer to the development sites, perhaps a bit more concerned, and yeah, you get that kind of natural balance that you'd expect. Yeah,
interesting.
I think what learnings have you had over the last year? I mean, coming in as a new councillor and then chairing one of the most important and consequential committees, public-facing committees the council has. What learnings would you think you found over the last year?
Well, it's interesting because Hammersmith and Fulham, we have a strategic committee and the local committee combined. So it's Planning and Development Control Committee, to give it its full name. Bit of a mouthful. I know some places have two separate, but we have it combined. So that's been interesting because you do get those minor schemes that come to committee. Just, you know, there may have been a number of objections. They come and it's fairly straightforward. And then you get the much larger schemes. You know, we have White City in Hammersmith and Fulham. We've got the third highest land value in the country. So there's always a lot of demand, always a lot of interest. So sort of figuring out how to approach those two different aspects of planning has been very interesting. And I should say, you know, most planning committees are the usual affair. So we spend several hours analysing the applications. Residents very rarely come to the committee. But on some occasions, as I say, we have a lot of interest. Some are more contentious. You get a lot of resident engagement. One recently was disrupted by a protest. We actually had to cut it short, which was a first and a new experience. So just dealing with the different aspects of planning has definitely been a learning curve.
And on, you mentioned land values as being a kind of consideration that, at least for developers, but I'm sure some members of the council will also think about when either supporting an application or perhaps challenging it. How acutely aware do you think some members of the council are around land values, viability assessments and the need to kind of bring forward affordable homes? So I think in short, do you think councillors or members of the planning committee are fully kind of socialised around land values and kind of the challenges that bringing forward affordable homes may take?
I think there needs to be a lot more education done on land value and the impact it can have on possible affordable housing delivery. Now, obviously, I'm on the planning committee and the other members of the planning committee will have received some education. They have some knowledge about it. But I think more broadly, probably just in terms of the general public as well, there should be a lot more education on that.
That's really quite interesting. And I wonder, has a committee thought about, or indeed have you had any briefings on different types of housing? Because obviously we've seen the challenges in bringing forward new homes with the second staircase requirement, also rising construction costs. Have members thought about what the kind of implications would be of introducing things like more student accommodation or even co-living spaces into the borough? Because that's most of the applications that we've seen ourselves working on over the past year.
Yeah, I mean, we've definitely had interest in terms of those kinds of applications to committee, and I'm sure there'll be some in the future. I think obviously we take each application as it comes. So in terms of the broader point about land value and the different kinds of housing and different sort of residential units that people might be interested in, I think more broadly there just needs to be some education, not just members of the planning committee, but councillors generally. But I should say, so we as a council have a 50% affordable housing target, and that obviously isn't always possible, and it isn't always it can't always be delivered for various reasons and for viability reasons. So that's where obviously the developer contributions come in that allow us to do the direct delivery schemes in other parts of the borough. But it's not just land value, I think it's also land availability. You know, Hammersmith and Fulham is one of the densest parts of the country, I think. So that's also an issue that we're cognizant of and have to be aware of.
Hmm.
Just following up on the fact that Hammersmith Fulham is quite a densely populated area, and you mentioned that very few members of the public turn up to the committee. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is? And do you think there's more that perhaps developers could do, or indeed ward councillors could do, to try and engage members of the public in the planning process?
Yeah, so this is an area that I'm very interested in, because obviously consultation and community engagement are integral parts of our planning system. Obviously, residents care about what's getting built in their area. They care about what it looks like. They care about what it is. That's completely understandable. I probably would as well. I definitely do. I think what we can do is look at how we can change how we engage different parts of the community and a broader spectrum of the community. Because just by its very nature, you know, the way consultation is structured, it might require you to send a letter in, or it might require you to send a number of emails. It might require you to be available in the middle of the day to attend residents' meetings. That by its very nature excludes maybe younger people, maybe people who are working, single parents. So it's very good that we have consultation and community engagement, but how do we broaden that? You know, one of the ideas I saw was maybe using text as a way of engaging younger people, you know, just a sort of text consultation that they can do in 1 minute or a few seconds, and then they've been sort of brought into the system as well.
I know certainly at Consilio we try to use various different means of reaching people, whether it's via, I'm not sure we've tried texts yet, but perhaps that's a good suggestion for us, but certainly around social media advertising, also trying to reach much broader audiences, because you can get a kind of breadth of suggestions, but also knowledge, but you can also reach people that are kind of less inclined to engage in the planning process.
And on that, do you think that sometimes it can be the case that perhaps those with the loudest voices perhaps dominate the responses to applications, and especially with things like housing? I mean, speaking as a young person, and you know, I think that's actually quite a young podcast, actually. But I think looking across, you know, planning committees, and we watched a lot of yours, and I'm definitely going to want to touch on the Shepherd Bush Market disruption in a moment.
I thought you might. Yeah.
Do you sometimes feel that people do? There is almost a you know, those with the loudest voices perhaps spend and are able to give more of their time and capacity to raising concerns about applications, and those disproportionately, you mentioned young people, those without access to the internet as well, for example, are less likely to be involved in applications and therefore less likely to have their voices heard when it comes to deliberations.
I think the point is to democratise the system as much as possible. So I don't begrudge any resident that does partake in the planning process and does make their voice heard, you know, but just by its very nature, the way it's set up, it is going to favour people that maybe have the time to do that or have the means to do that and have an understanding of how the planning system works, have been able to take the time to read the report. So I don't think it's, you know, again, I don't begrudge the individuals that are taking part. I just think it's about broadening that and democratising as much as possible. Mm-hmm. Just so we have as much of the community engaged as possible.
So touching on your role specifically as the chair, I watched the planning committee a few months ago, which you have referenced already, which was the Shepherd Bush Market. And I have to say, you know, I've chaired CLP meetings and there's been disruptions. I've been involved in different parts of politics. I did not expect a planning committee in Hammersmith and Fulham to kind of bring out such strong opinions to the point where you as the chair, and I remember watching it and kind of thinking how difficult you must be in that position. Tell us about that. Tell us, for those of us that haven't perhaps watched it or aren't familiar with it, what happened?
Yeah, that was quite unexpected and quite interesting. Like you say, it was interesting to be there in the room and to experience it. So, you know, there'd been a Twitter campaign beforehand saying we obviously oppose this application. And they put out that they were going to picket the meeting. And so I thought this meant they'll be outside the council offices and they'll sort of, you know, picket us on the way in and then that'll be it. So that didn't happen. So we thought, oh, okay, so I guess there's not going to be a protest. And by the way, I, again, completely support their right to picket and support their right to protest. You know, not even going into whether or not they're right or wrong. You know, I completely support and endorse their democratic right to do that. And I don't begrudge them doing it at all. So we get there in the room and we're getting through the officer reports. And then we get to some speakers. So we have one speaker in favour and one speaker against. And the speaker in favour comes and it's all going smoothly. The speaker against comes up. And as soon as they're finished speaking, this protest erupts. And if you know, you watch the video, it was quite a loud, disruptive protest, which I guess is the point of protest, to be honest. So we thought, okay, let's wait for them to maybe quiet down. That wasn't happening. It started to actually get quite tense in the room. Mm-hmm. And I was quite struck by the fact that it wasn't the people protesting sort of getting in the faces of the committee members. It was people in the public gallery actually getting in each other's faces. So traders who are in favour of the application and traders who are against the application, the campaigners, you know, it was getting quite tense. And we could either wait for this to die down or, you know, wait for the police to come. That could have been an escalation. So ultimately the decision was made to, you know, end the meeting and reschedule it for another time.
Mm. Interesting. And it obviously came back to committee a couple of weeks later and was approved.
It did, yeah, and without a protest.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Were you in that second one? Were you a bit on edge? A bit kind of...
Well, I probably was a bit on edge and I probably was expecting there to be another disruption, to be honest, and quite surprised that there wasn't. Mm. And again, not going into the sort of merits of the application or why it was approved or, you know, why people voted the way they did or didn't, we were probably quite surprised that there wasn't a protest. And now, obviously, the application's gone to the Mayor of London, so that's still in play.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So more protests to come.
Perhaps.
I can only imagine. I mean, I've shared my fair share of CLP meetings that have kind of descended into major chaos. You can probably find it on CNN at some point. But I wonder...
I've actually just become the chair of a CLP, Chelsea and Fulham.
Oh, good.
So all this is worrying me a little bit, actually. That's what I have to look forward to.
Well, you have two seasoned chairs.
I might ask you for advice. Yeah.
Well, actually, I'd like to ask you for some advice.
Yeah, go on.
Were we ever lucky, or indeed any other kind of planning chairs listening, what would you say in the kind of 18 months that you've been in post that you would say are the do's and don'ts as a planning committee chair? What are your true learnings from your experience?
I'd say, you know, in the case of the protest, there was a massive disruption and it came down to me as the chair to decide what to do. So the police came to the building and they asked me, do you want us to go in and remove the people from the room? Physically remove them. And I didn't want that to happen because that would be an escalation and, you know, they have every right to be there to protest. Do we wait for them to die down? Do we try and engage with them? In the end, I tried to engage with them. And I think that's probably the number one do. Mm. Engage with residents, no matter how they're expressing themselves,
absolutely,
whether they're for or against the application. Because at the end of the day, they're the ones that will have to work near the space, live in the space, use the space. And actually, even if they're not residents, you know, maybe some of the people protesting the Shepherd's Market weren't residents or they didn't even live in the borough. They're still people who care about the site, the development, whatever it might be. So I'd say a big do is engage with residents. Listen to them respectfully, even if over the course of the committee meeting you decide actually you're going to vote in favour of the application or you're going to vote against the application. Take what they're saying at face value and treat them with respect because they're the ones that will be impacted by it.
I think that's worthy advice, and anyone listening, I think, will certainly take that on board.
Yeah. Also, read the report.
Well, absolutely. Well, I think from our side of the
room... Know the agenda.
Know the agenda, yeah.
And the scheme you're voting on, too. Yeah. But actually, I was quite touched in watching your campaign video, in which you talked about your kind of personal experience in housing, or indeed how the housing crisis has affected you. I wonder how that has... that's informed the work that you do on the planning committee. And of course you take every scheme on its merits, but would you mind kind of telling us a bit more around your background and how that experience has informed your work as a councillor?
Yeah, definitely. So I've always been interested in housing, planning, architecture, you know, the built environment. But as I say in my campaign video for London Assembly, as a teenager, I was evicted. Me and my mum were evicted from private housing. That was obviously an extremely traumatic event. And I'm by no means unique in that, you know, so many people, Londoners, have experienced eviction or housing insecurity of any kind, whether it's living with damp mold and indignified housing, sharing even is not really what people want to be doing into a certain age. So that's been an extremely transformative experience for me and just massively increased my interest in housing or my commitment to housing as a priority. As you say, you know, obviously I take each application as it comes. Just have to say that caveat, probably one of many that I'll say over this recording as chair of the planning committee. But I think it's just something I'm imbued with, you know, housing as a human right, housing as the most fundamental thing, the cornerstone of everything else, really.
How do you think the kind of development of new homes has shaped modern day Hammersmith and Fulham? It's a borough that is very close to Westminster. It's in its characteristics, I think it's quite suburban in parts, but also very close to the Thames and kind of the centre of the city. What do you think the kind of new character of Hammersmith and Fulham has been as a result of kind of new developments over the last perhaps decade?
Yeah, so we as a council have a 3,000 affordable home target to be built or underway over the next 4 years. And obviously that's, again, contingent on planning approval. Again, have to just caveat that. And again, that's a target of 50% affordable housing in each development. It's a combination of council-led schemes, partnership schemes, acquisitions within private developments. So if we take that as a sort of broad ambition, we want to massively increase the number of affordable homes in the borough because... Actually, you know, I mentioned the fact that my ward, Fulham Reach, is one-third private tenants, one-third social housing, one-third homeowners. That's the same case across Hammersmith and Fulham. Mm. So you know, we have to provide housing for all the different kinds of people that need it, people in social housing, but also people who want to privately rent or buy. I'll just take you through some of the schemes that have recently been consented. Got Hartop Point and Lanoy Point, which is 134 new energy efficient homes, 84% affordable. Farm Lane, 31 new homes. Lily Road, 42 new homes. Edith Summer School House, which you may have heard of, it was approved, went to the Secretary of State, was approved in 2022. There's 133 new homes, 100% affordable. They are all direct delivery schemes. That's not even to mention the private schemes or mixed schemes that have been granted consent. So there's a lot going on.
And that sounds like an impressive list of direct delivery schemes. And I think, especially at the moment, which the market is kind of heating up, and it's got a number of pressures around the delivery of second staircase cores, but also rising construction costs, that it's good to see Labour councils building, I think.
Hmm. Absolutely. And you know, obviously, there have been those pressures. So it's getting more and more difficult, but we're still committed to doing that and to reaching that target as much as possible, once again, contingent on planning approval. Mm. And we take each case as it comes.
The London Assembly. Mm. Obviously, I mean, at the time of recording, I think we're around 74, maybe 73 days away from May 2nd. You're putting your name forward to be one of the Labour candidates for the London wide list. Tell us a bit about your campaign.
Yeah, so I think City Hall and the London Assembly generally has a massively important role to play when it comes to planning. You know, obviously the London Plan, the document that all our local plans have to comply with. But in other ways, City Hall is important. It's the political leadership. I know, you know, we can't do much without central government funding, which has stalled. But still, I think the London Assembly, City Hall is an important sort of political leadership body when it comes to planning and housing and other areas. My campaign, personally, so I'm campaigning on two issues. I chose to keep it to two issues that are really personal to me and that I'm actually passionate about. Housing, based on my experience of eviction and everything else that I mentioned previously, and violence against women and girls. And actually, if you take those two areas, they're areas that cross borough boundaries. They are London-wide issues. Housing doesn't, you know, the housing crisis doesn't stop in one area and start in another. It affects everyone in London. And it's the same with violence against women and girls. So I think the opportunity to be a London-wide Assembly member specifically means that I can talk about these things in a more broad and holistic sense. So that's really the main reason why I put myself forward, to be able to not just campaign on those issues, but help the mayor as much as possible and support the mayor's work on those two issues. And just to touch on that, obviously, we've smashed council house building records. You know, built more council houses started or finished since the 1970s in London. That's a record the Mayor of London can be very proud of, and I want to sort of support that. But also on violence against women and girls. You know, I mentioned, you know, in my campaign material, violence against women and girls is something that can't be solved solely through policing and enforcement, because it's overwhelmingly usually someone who the victim knows. It's not actually overwhelmingly someone on the street or a stranger or someone in an alleyway. So it has to be done through a culture shift. And I think the Mayor of London, to see a man in politics leading the way on that argument is very inspirational.
Mm. Excellent. I mean, no, that's really interesting. Tell us a bit about how you found the process and kind of the campaigning. You know, you're obviously going to speak to lots of Labour Party members, talking to people right across the city. Are you finding that those two issues are really resonating with people?
Yeah, definitely housing is you know, just top of the agenda now. And I think it's top of the agenda because, obviously, we are going through a housing crisis, and I think we should call it the housing catastrophe, really. It's just a national emergency. It's beyond crisis now. It's just completely all-consuming, and people of all generations and all backgrounds are being impacted by it. So that's why it's high on the agenda. But then it's also down to campaigning groups like Priced Out. They've done really good work on that, and I think, unsurprisingly, it's all made up of young people. You know, it's young people who are bearing the brunt of the housing crisis. So among Labour Party members, I think there is more and more of a recognition that housing is the number one issue. So I have found that there is a lot of interest in that as an issue. And actually, it's interesting because I'm going for the London-wide, I've been travelling all across London, campaigning and canvassing and meeting different Labour Party members. And again, it's just clear to see, no matter where you are in London, the housing crisis is there, plain to see, you know?
And actually, the intersection between housing and the kind of difficulties that some young women, but particularly those in domestic violence situations, is certainly something that, when grappled with, providing that security for people, I think will certainly give safe refuge for any women, particularly that are facing that kind of difficult challenges in their life.
Definitely. If I can just say as well on that, you know, one of the reasons why I think housing is so important is because I think it is the intersectional issue. So if you have insecure housing and undignified housing, whether you're overcrowded or damp and mould or whatever it might be, you can't focus properly on your education, can't focus on your work, your health deteriorates, crime goes up. It's a symptom of inequality. If we fix the housing crisis properly, it will have, like you say, a knock-on effect on all those other areas.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, and housing maybe isn't so much an ends, but the means to achieve the ends, right, which are greater equality across London. That's really interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to touch on something that was in the news only a couple of days ago, which is Michael Gove's announcement. He seems to be announcing lots of things, as if we're in a general election year, around short-term lets. I think, putting aside your kind of role as a plan committee chair, and obviously some of these new rules will affect kind of permission or consent that's required for these types of homes. What your view is on kind of short-term lets? I can imagine a place like Hammersmith and Fulham, you've got lots of Airbnbs, lots of kind of short-term kind of housing that people look to and seek out. Is it an issue in the borough? Do you get it come up in your casework, or is it something that's kind of personally affecting you? How do you think the Labour group, obviously speaking for them at large, but how do you think the Labour group in Hammersmith for Fulham is going to look to kind of address this new initiative that's been announced by the government?
Yeah, I think we do get some interest on this from residents, particularly people who live next to an Airbnb. You know, the flat on the ground floor of my building is an Airbnb. And luckily, there's not been much disruption, and I don't think I would complain personally, but, you know, I get it. I get why people are concerned about them. I think this is an issue of supply. So in my opinion, and I think the statistics and the research bears this out as well, the housing crisis is a crisis of supply. However, we have one of the lowest long-term vacancy rates in Europe. I think we have the lowest, apart from Poland. Poland has the lowest, and we're the second lowest. So it's actually a question about, if we were to address that short-term lets problem and long-term vacancy problem, would it actually make a massive difference? Would it give us the supply that we need? it will be a drop in the water. It will be a significant number, you know, maybe tens of thousands or 100,000 or so, but would it address the 4.3 million home deficit that we have, which is a figure put out by the Centre for Cities after a report that they did? It probably wouldn't. So I think it's, we have to look at this more broadly. You know, how do we fix the supply problem? And the only way we do that is by building.
Which is a perfect segue to my next question, which is around Labour's kind of, new YIMBY position that I've kind of spoken about. What are your thoughts on these ideas around planning passports, kind of driving forward new housing in areas where there is high levels of opposition? How do you think that will work in practice? And if you were successful in becoming a list member in London Assembly, how do you think that may impact the role of the Assembly and actually the Mayor?
So I think first we have to start with why. That I didn't come up with that phrase, by the way, someone else did, but I think it's a good one. Start with why. So in Hammersmith and Fulham, we have roughly 3,000 people who are on the housing register who are in desperate need of social housing. Some time ago, when the Tories were in administration, they took off loads of people that were on the housing register. So I suspect the actual figure is way higher. And I think that's the same case across the country. So the actual numbers of people that are in desperate need of affordable housing is a lot higher than we think it is. But then again, it doesn't take into account people who are in undignified housing, people who are sharing, living with parents. You know, these people are already there in our boroughs and in our city. It's not as if we build, you know, loads more people will come. They're already there, but not living in adequate housing. So that's the why. That's why we need planning reform. That's why we need to massively increase supply, because these are real human tragedies that are taking place and it's holding people back. So I'm very much in favour of the national proposals that have been put forward. You know, we have this case-by-case discretionary model laid down by the Town and Country Planning Act 1947. It has its benefits. It means residents are engaged, there's community engagement, there's consultation. But as a system, it does have its faults. I don't think the current Labour proposals is to do away with that planning regime, but, you know, in its entirety. But any movement to ease the planning process nationally, I think, is a good one. Again, that 4.3 million home deficit, we're not going to fix that clearly with the planning system as it is, unchanged. So I'm very much in favour. I was very pleased to hear Keir Starmer say he's a YIMBY. I'm very pleased to hear that we're looking at the Green Belt, which, again, as I'm sure all the listeners will know and you all know, is not an area of outstanding natural beauty. So a lot of people hear the word Green Belt, the term Green Belt, and they think this is some pristine countryside. And if we do away with it, we're doing away with the green and pleasant land. That's not actually what it is. It's light industry. It was designed really to prevent urban growth, not to preserve natural landscapes. So I'm very, very pleased to hear that we're looking at that as well, but also looking at intensification in city centres. There's a lot that can be done with densification, with mansarding. Again, you know, that's owing to a whole variety of factors, and you take each application as it comes, but I think you have to look at the whole scope of things. But I'm very pleased to hear about the national proposals.
I think naturally it's quite refreshing to hear that, actually. Only someone who in-depthly understands the kind of challenges that we face in not just London but also on the outskirts, but what the new proposals, if they are successful, because I think, and we discuss this all the time in the office, how difficult it may be with new members of parliament in areas that are not so favourable to new housing, who may represent some more suburban seats that where I used to live in my native Enfield. About a third of the borough, actually it's 29-point-something% of the borough's green belt. Right. I've seen some of the green belt allocations, and they are grey in nature. And it's, it will be a real challenge, but I think it's positive to know that if you are successful, and I hope you you are, we'll at least see the new government at least bring forward measures that can kind of accelerate new housing delivery.
And it's easy for me to say because there is no green belt in Hammersmith and Fulham. So I can say this, you know, easily, but I think that's an interesting point, because regardless of the specifics, looking at the green belt, easing the planning regulations, whatever it might be, the thing that's been lacking has been the political leadership and political will. That is what will give those MPs in those rural seats or seats with green belt the confidence and the energy to make the arguments they need to make. And that's probably the most reassuring thing to have seen in the Labour leadership. The political will is there to talk about housing and to talk about planning.
Two final questions. one ask of the next government, whomever they may be?
Yeah, so I hope it's a Labour government, obviously, but you can't take anything for granted. I think if I have only one ask from the next government, again, I hope it's a Labour government, it's around public investment. We have extremely low public investment compared to other comparable developed economies. That obviously has so many knock-on effects when it comes to housing, when it comes to transport infrastructure, when it comes to productivity and all the rest of it. And that's been lagging behind for a very, very long time. And the last 14 years haven't helped at all. So public investment is obviously the key missing ingredient. It would reassure the private sector. It would encourage development. It would, again, impact housing. It would impact transport. It would impact public services. It would impact everything. And so I'm extremely reassured, again, to hear the Labour leadership talk about, you know, National Wealth Fund. That's an incredibly strong proposal. That's talking about direct public investment in cooperation with the private sector to you know, really improve those areas that I've spoken about, housing and transport infrastructure and everything. So I guess my ask is keep focused on that as a priority. And obviously that's subject to the fiscal rules. But something like the National Wealth Fund, which is very much, you know, sort of flagship Labour policy, that's really reassuring to see. And it means they're taking public investment seriously.
Excellent. And one ask for the next Mayor of London.
Yeah, so again, I hope that's Sadiq Khan. And you know, I'm doing everything I can to make sure that is Sadiq Khan. I've heard Sadiq talk about housing as a human right in interviews, and I know it's something that he believes in. Affordable housing is a human right. I'd love to see that enshrined in some way, you know, okay, in some formal way. What that would then mean is that, again, the political will, the political leadership, which has very much been there, you know, we're building so many more council houses and there's money going to local authorities, and he said it in interviews, it would just send an even stronger signal out. You know, housing is the number one priority. You know, keep providing councils with the powers necessary to address the housing crisis, the funding necessary to address the housing crisis. Again, this is contingent on the central government, but things like enabling councils to buy private property to boost affordable housing, you know, so much has been done already, but just housing is what I would say.
And on that note, I'd like to thank you, Ahmed, for your time, Oscar, and also Nathan, who will have to edit down much of our bloops and burps. But yes, thank you so much. All the best with your campaign. And we look forward to watching even more Hammersmith and Fulham planning committee sessions.
Honestly, it's already in my diary for the next one. I've had a look. It's 72 days until okay, the 2nd of May.
Great.
As of now, when we listen to this, when we publish this, it'll be slightly low time. But yeah, great. Best of luck.
Thank you so much for having me. And hopefully not many protests at the next one. But if you want to protest, you're welcome. More than welcome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, that's it from us. Thanks for listening to another episode of Better Places. You can listen to our back catalogue of episodes at conciliocomms.com/podcast. And don't forget to like and subscribe on whatever platform you listen on. Bye 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 bye.